Bienvenidos a todos ustedes. Es un placer tener cada uno de ustedes aquí esta noche. Es un placer estar aquí. Stephen, you're supposed to hold your hand up. I was putting him to the test. You heard what I told him to do last night. And he's sitting over there like that's normal. So, all right, you failed the test. But let me start over. Good evening. It's a pleasure to see all of you here. It's certainly a pleasure for me to be here. Thoroughly enjoying my time. I did not go on the hike today for a number of reasons, but I know I missed out on a wonderful experience. But far more wonderful for me than a hike is to see all of these young faces that represent so many young hearts that chose to be here because of the spiritual benefits that can be gained from the kind of wonderful program you all have put together here. And it's a great honor and thrill for me to be a part of it. I want to talk to you tonight about someone. I can't surprise you because the subject's already been put on the flyers that have been sent out. But Mr. Bible says, I want you to meet a very normal person. And I use Mr. Bible a lot. And he's one of my favorite little graphics. So you'll probably be seeing him a number of times. Hi, I'm Noah, a very normal person. Maybe he dresses a little funny, but I have to admire his beard. But stress that he is a very normal person. At least he was back in his day in terms of looking like, dressing like everybody else until certain things began to happen in his life. And we see these descriptions of Noah in various passages. He's called a just man in Genesis 6. And it says that he's blameless in his generations, verse 9. He walked with God. Same verse. He did according to all the Lord commanded him. Verse 22. And in 2 Peter, he's called a preacher of righteousness. Now, if we go back to his day and then say, with this description, that he was a very normal person, then that wouldn't quite be true. Because he was the only one out of his generation that God thought was worth saving from the coming destruction. So spiritually, he was quite abnormal. But in every other sense, he was as normal as any other human being. But I appreciate this description, and we're not going to go back and read all of the passages associated with the life of Noah. We don't have time for that. I'm assuming most or all of us know the basic or all of the details of that story. But I really want to focus on him and the task that God gave him to make a particular point or several points at the end of the lesson. Well, Noah says, look, I have a really big problem. You might see me in most respects as a very normal person, but I've got a huge problem. God told me that I have to do something that to me seems to be impossible. God gave me this mountain, and then he expects me to move it. Well, that idea comes from a verse in Matthew 17 that we'll get to a little bit later, Lord willing. God gave me something in my life that to me seems impossible for me to deal with. That's a mountain, whatever it really looks like. And this is what it is. He said, Noah, I want you to build an ark. I want you to survive 40 days of rain and a cataclysmic flood over the whole world with your family and pairs of all classes of animals. I want you to float over the earth for a year in a boat that you make with your own hands. Then I want you to begin all over again to repopulate the whole earth with only the 8 of you who will be left. Would you call that a mountain? It's like almost a mountain range. Can you imagine just the last one? Can you imagine 8 people on the whole planet? And God says to you and the other 7, I want you to be fruitful, and I want you to multiply, and I want you to fill the earth. Well, I thought about that many, many times. I still can't wrap my mind around that. I've got 13 grandchildren. Well, 13 in August, Lord willing. And it's taken a bunch of years just to get those 13. Can you imagine having the assignment? I don't want you just to have, you know, a nice, good-sized family. I want you to fill the earth up. Talk about a mountain. But that's just one of a number of things. Okay, God gave me this mountain, and he expects me to move it. Well, sometimes we get so used to the story of Noah that we just, oh yeah, there was the flood, he built the ark, he got the animals, and then the world was destroyed, and then he started over, and here we are, thousands of years later. But I like to go back and spend a little bit more time on some details that Noah had to wrestle with that maybe we don't think about as often as we just quickly sort of dismiss the story because we know what it's about. But Noah says, look, this is the mountain God gave me, but I just have one small question. How am I supposed to do that? Well, those are all the things I've got to do, but before I can conceive of that, I have one more question, or actually maybe several. I have more questions and would very much appreciate some answers. Well, what kind of questions could he possibly have? Well, maybe what is rain? Because as far as we know, it hadn't rained before. We know there was a mist that came up from the ground and watered the ground. But God, what is rain? And while we're at it, what's an ark? You want me to build this thing? No, I want you to build this thing. Build an ark. What's a flood? Not sure what rain is. I'm sure not sure what a flood is. What about all that water? How can that much water possibly come from anywhere? Where's it going to come from? You're talking about covering up the whole world? How am I supposed to build something that big? Don't have a garage. Never seen anything that big. Big enough for us. Okay, 8 people, that's not too big an assignment, but for numbers of every kind of animal, every class of animal, and all that has to go along with that? How can I possibly collect all those animals? Have you ever thought about how he might have thought about that? Where am I supposed to find them? And do I even know what they all are? I can only imagine that when Noah first was hit with this assignment, if he was as normal as probably he was, all kinds of questions filled his mind. Such as these. And we're not treated to any information about how much detail God gave him. We just have the little sketch. Build an ark, gather the animals, and go inside and float around for a little over a year. Well, not only that, how will I get those animals here? Will they come if I just call them? Here, doggies. Here, wild cats. How am I going to feed them? How am I going to take care of them? That's not exactly in my line of experience, especially over a long period of time. About those trees, where are they? And how do I cut them down? How many am I going to need? And after I cut them down, how am I going to get them all here? All kinds of logistical questions. Build an ark. Okay. But now when you decide how do you do that, all kinds of practical questions start. I have no idea how long his list was. But I can well imagine his thinking of at least these few things that we're touching on here. How do I convince my family that you told me to do this? That's its own assignment. And most of us have heard the old Bill Cosby thing, right? How do I convince them that it was actually you talking to me? And how do I keep them convinced? No one's going to believe me. They're going to make fun of me. How am I going to manage that? Because I'm assuming I cannot build this thing in a week. In fact, a century is more like it. So how am I going to maintain my family's confidence, and how am I going to deal with all these people, not just around here when I get started, but all those people who live in other places who are going to hear what's going on here, and they're going to take their summer vacations to come here and watch me. And probably a lot of them are going to laugh and have all kinds of horrible things to say. How do I manage that? What happens if I do all of this And then it doesn't rain. What is rain again? Would you explain that to me? Well, all kinds of questions. Okay. If I really have to do it, I better make a list of the major tasks and organize the project. Do you figure Noah was an organizer? Do you figure he had to be an organizer? My wife and I are in the middle of trying to get a summer camp put together. And those who come to the summer camp just show up and say, wow, this is neat. What'd it take you to put this together? A couple of weeks? No, I started in December. In December for a camp in July? Yeah. And sometimes that's too late. But this is nothing compared to what Noah had to do with. Lists, 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 and other lists. And lots of lists that branch off of the primary list of things that have to be done. For example, this is just a real short version of a list that he very well had to at least carry in his head if he didn't actually write it down. I've got to choose a construction site. Where am I going to do this? Need a lot of room. I've got to select the trees, and it's going to require many, many of them. Then I've got to cut them down, and I've got to remove the bark from all those trees. It's a little bit of work. Then I've got to haul those trees to the construction site, and then without any benefit of power equipment, I've got to cut all those logs into planks and boards and beams of various sizes. I've got to drill holes in them for the pegs that go in to hold them to the framework. I've got to assemble a lot of those planks into scaffolding because after we get higher than this, I've got to have some help getting way on up there. I'm going to have to gather a lot of pitch. So I'm going to need barrels. Where am I going to get the barrels? I've got to make brushes because we're going to be busy painting that whole thing. I've got to have lots of brushes. Where do I get those? Do I have to make those too? I've got to make ladders and platforms, gather provisions for a full year. I've got to gather enough to feed all those animals for a year. Us, eight, we ate. I've got to construct pens inside the ark. Decide who goes where, gather all these pairs of animals. I've got to put them into the pens, be sure the door shuts very tightly when it does start to rain. I have to keep my family believing and focused. And I've got to construct such an ark that it can withstand the cataclysmic upheaval and stay afloat for a year. Now, that's just a very short list. What in the world, besides this, was going through Noah's mind year after year after year? As one list would be crossed out, another list would be attacked, and then another list and another list. It's amazing what this man did. And the things that he had to think of and provide and come up with when all we have is the short description. Moses, I want you to build an ark. These are the dimensions. This is what I want you to do with it. And then he's got to figure all the rest out. Unless God was gracious enough to give him a full-fledged list of everything and how to do it. That was not an easy task. It consumed his life for a century and his family's life. But the day came when everything was crossed off the list. All the questions had been answered, and God had enabled me to do everything he told me to do and to complete every task associated with that. Took a long time. But finally, after I crossed off my last list, I was able to look. There it is. By means of God's marvelous power, he had removed all obstacles, he'd removed all doubts, and he did exactly what he had promised. So I just have to think that Noah celebrated a little bit. Obviously, he got someone to take his picture. As he says, ta-da! Did you notice the bandages on his thumbs? Please notice that. So. The ark was ready. It only took a century, but it was ready. God ripped up Noah's mountain, and he took it completely away. Now, when Noah first heard it, this is what I want you to do. It had to seem absolutely, incredibly impossible. We face things like that. Maybe not that exact assignment, but things that are equally to us seemingly incredibly impossible. How in the world do I do that? How do I get around this? How do I deal with this? And our assumption is I can't. At least not on my own. I can't. Let's list some things that Noah could do. He could make a work schedule. He could organize everything very carefully. He could find the trees and cut them and saw them into planks. He could assemble the framework of the great ship. He could construct scaffolding and fine pitch and make tools and motivate his family, and that might have been a hard one. He could follow the plans God gave him. He could measure and cut with care, build the pens, and all those other things. He could do all of that. But there are some things that only God could do in that story. And that if it was going to come out like God told him previously that it was going to come out, Noah could only do what he could do, but then everything else was left up to God. And we'll just list a few. Only God could ensure that everything would happen during that century of time so that Noah would have everything he needed to do what he could do. Only God could provide all of the trees, access to the resources of pitch. Only God could provide so many things that Noah on his own could not possibly have done. Only God could cause and control the flood so that the ark would not be threatened. I mean, when you think about it, everything on earth was destroyed except the ark. Only God could make that happen. Only God could cleanse the earth of all evil men and dry it out for a brand new beginning. Noah couldn't touch that one. And only God could enable Noah's family to reproduce at a level that would repopulate the entire world in fairly short time. When he says, be fruitful, when God says, be fruitful, that's not like you and me just saying, good luck. It's not only in the form of a commandment, but it carries with it a blessing, which means I will make you fruitful, like he did Adam and Eve in the beginning. Only God could do that. And so Noah had to take his assignment, and probably fairly quickly he realized his own limitations. Okay, I can do this, but how in the world is the rest of this going to happen? I can't do any of that. And this is just a very short list. Well, when everything was over, the flood came. Noah's family was saved. He was able to leave the ark and resume a normal life. And the earth began to be repopulated. Back to normal. After one of the greatest events in the history of this planet, everything resumed again as normal. So what do you think? Out of all the things that happened in relation to that story, how much of it happened because Noah and his family worked really hard? A lot of it. They worked hard. They did tons of work that I cannot imagine doing. So yeah, they got a lot of the credit. Okay, how much of it was because Noah planned for things to happen? A lot of it. He had to plan. That's why we looked through that list of things to do. He planned, he organized, he obtained, he gave work schedules, he maintained some kind of a very heavy schedule himself. He was able to and did a lot. They all did. How much of it was because God took control and did what Noah was not able to do? All the rest of it. So this was not a one-sided deal. It wasn't just God doing this. It was Noah and his family doing a massive portion also. And when you put everything they did together with what only God could do, we have a magnificent story in the early part of Genesis. With not nearly as much detail, maybe, as we would like. But it brings me to make a couple of observations. This is one of them. Faith is based on something that's real. I think we understand that, but sometimes maybe we forget. At least a lot of people in the world seem to disconnect on this. Faith, when we act by faith, it's always based on something that's real. It has something to back it up. Faith is not just something that pops into our minds or our hearts out of the air. It's a reaction to strong evidence that we have. And we'll give some examples in a moment. Faith is not a hunch or just a cool idea. It's not a blind emotional guess. It's not just the art of positive thinking. It's based on something that's real. It's based on some kind of really strong evidence. By faith, Noah, when warned about things to come, or things not yet seen, in holy fear built an ark to save his family. Did Noah have some evidence to convince him he needed to act, even when he had no idea what the end result was going to look like? Yeah, God had spoken to him. And God himself had assured him, Noah, this is what you are to do, this is what I'm going to do, and this is the end result. He had strong evidence that he was given a divine assignment, even though he didn't see or even know a lot of the things connected with it. What's rain? What's a flood? Where are all these animals going to come from? He didn't know the answers to all those questions. But he believed that God gave him the assignment. He believed that God would do what he said he was going to do. And he believed that he had to do his part. And so based on the evidence, he acted without knowing, without being able to see things that as yet had not happened. By faith, he reacted to the evidence. He didn't react by faith until God instructed him about things not yet seen. But after God instructed him, based on that evidence, Noah went to work. And he did it by faith. If someone lives by faith, that's going to be evident in that person's life. You can't just say, I have faith, and that prove anything. If I have faith, it can't help but be shown in my life. Faith is not invisible. Faith shows itself through action. And if there's no action to demonstrate the faith, then there's no evidence that there's any faith. It's just a statement. It's a feeling. But it's not real. Which I think is why Jesus said, if you have just the smallest piece of faith, as small as a mustard seed grain, you can move mountains with it. How many times have we heard people say, I just need to have more faith? No. You don't need more faith, you need faith. Apparently, if you think you need more faith, what you now have is not faith. Because it takes only the smallest amount to move a mountain. Well, maybe, what if I don't need to move a mountain? Then it should take even less. But it's got to be faith, not just a good feeling or a wish or a desire or a hope. And sometimes we get ourselves into trouble thinking, if I just had more faith, this and this and this. We ought to be saying, no, if I had faith, this and this and this. True faith may lead to dramatic results. It certainly did in Noah's case. And you can find many stories in the Bible that backs that up as well. Everything on dry land that had the breath of life in its nostrils died. Every living thing on the face of the earth was wiped out. Men and animals and the creatures that move along the ground and the birds of the air were wiped from the earth. Only Noah was left. Dramatic? Rather. And it's interesting that the ark didn't have a rudder. No instructions to build a rudder. Now, why in the world do you need a rudder? Well, you need a rudder to steer the boat. Well, it's interesting, when God included his instructions to Noah, he didn't include this key element. Noah had to trust God to steer because he didn't have the means to do it. When we live by faith, we often have to do the same thing. There are just certain things we encounter that we don't have a rudder to guide ourselves through it. We have to put that in God's hands and have faith, what's really faith, and trust God to find the way to lead us through it. I think Noah is one of the great stories, the object stories, about what faith really demands of us. And it has made me admire Noah so much more, that there are so many things he had no clue, maybe when he got up on the 938th day, of where certain things are going to come from that day. But he could look back on all the other days, and somehow or another, whenever he needed something, God found a way to always make sure it was reachable and gettable. And Noah had to continue to act, trusting that God would provide enough trees, enough pitch, enough animals, enough food, enough everything to accomplish the task. So what do we learn from Noah? Number of things, including this: live a righteous life. Live a life as best you can that makes you right with God. Even if you're the only one, like Noah, it's going to be noticed. And if God is the only one that notices that you are the only one who's righteous, and all of those with whom you associate, who else needs to know it? If God sees it, that's enough. But be righteous, no matter what the circumstance. And listen to what God says, because your life literally depends on it. Not only here on the planet, but certainly so when the old body dies and then eternity is facing us. Plan ahead. It wasn't raining while Noah was building the ark. But once it was finished and started raining, well, it's a good thing it was finished when it started raining. Plan ahead. Get your life in order now. Set your dreams and goals with the right priorities now, so that when the rain comes, you're ready and you're prepared. Act on your faith. Don't just talk about it. Don't just say, I have it. Act on it. Show that it's there. Show that it's real. Noah could have believed his entire life what God had said and done nothing about it, and he would have drowned along with everybody else. Faith is real only when it displays itself in action. And so if things aren't going right in your life, maybe it's because this thing you call faith isn't pushing you to do anything. You're not acting upon it. You're just hoping that God will step in and you won't have to do anything. Well, I don't think it ever works that way. Typically, God waits to see how much we're willing to do. And when we've done what we can do, that's usually when he steps in and carries us where we can't go. Stay fit. When you're 600 years old, someone might ask you to do something really big. More importantly, stay fit spiritually, because you never know when God needs someone to do something that's special, and there's no one around that's fit to do it except you. And this lesson is not so much about providence, though I love to teach about that. It's just common sense. Learn from Noah. Learn from so many other stories similar. And don't listen to critics. Someone criticizes you, makes fun of you, turns away from you, breaks a relationship with you, because you really want to have real faith and you want to act on that faith. Just get on with what has to be done. It doesn't matter if he or she doesn't like me. It doesn't matter if they make fun of me. It doesn't matter what they think or what they say. The only thing that matters is, what does God want me to do, and am I going to do it? As long as I'm right with God, absolutely no one else matters, no matter what the relationship is. Speed isn't always an advantage, so don't get in too big a hurry. Even the turtles were on board with the cheetahs. So the goal that we all have is to spend eternity with Jesus Christ and with the Father. If someone seems way ahead of me spiritually, okay. I don't doubt that many, many are. Keep plugging, keep going, keep growing, keep acting on the faith. God will pay attention. And be patient. The ark wasn't built in a year, and the flood wasn't finished until after 40 days and 40 nights. And these problems of yours you're working on won't be solved in a night, probably. And if you've been praying about it for a month, pray another month. Pray for a year. Keep praying. Be patient for God to find the right time to help you move whatever mountain it is that you're struggling with, because He promises us that He will give us His help. No matter the nature of the storm or the fierceness of it, when you're one with God, there's always a rainbow at the end of it. It's going to come out well. Let the world go to pot if it decides it's going to pot, but don't you go to pot. You stay strong, trust in the Lord. If you ever find yourself depending upon the opinion of men, you're in a heap of trouble, because men will always let you down. And sometimes that's true even with fellow Christians. If your faith is based on how other Christians are treating you, you're in trouble. I'm so glad. I've said this a number of times, and I'm not going to take the time to explain it tonight, but I'll just throw it out there. I've said a number of times, I'm so happy that Jesus will be my judge and not my brethren. Because sometimes, even though I'm a Christian, I've got weaknesses. And I might afflict you with my weakness. Hopefully I never do that to the degree that you lose faith, that you lose spirit, or that you lose motivation to follow Christ. Not any man or any group of men. Well, I tell you the truth, Jesus said, Matthew 17:20. If you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move. Nothing will be impossible to you. That was true long before Matthew 17, verse 20. It was true in the days of Noah. It was true in the days of the patriarchs. It was certainly true in the days of Jesus and the apostles, and it's equally true in our day. Real faith, motivating us to serve and honor God with our lives, can help us move what appear to us as huge, huge mountains. And I encourage you to live by that principle. Thank you so much for your attention. We'll take a short break and then come back for what follows. Thank you very much. Well, we have a number of questions tonight, and good questions. And because there's a number of them, I'll keep my answers as brief as I think appropriate. I do want you to come back tomorrow. Do you think that it was that Noah thought that it was going to be almost impossible to build the ark so big? You know, that's, without being able to read his mind, I can only associate it with maybe how I would have reacted. And I think it had to be a shocking thing to him to contemplate the size of that thing, because we have no reason to believe he was acquainted with anything that big. That maybe he was, but we have, I don't know of any evidence that would show us that he had any association with something that huge. So I think, yeah, he probably was intimidated at least for a good while by that big a thing. And do you think that it was a test of faith from God? Yeah, I do. I think that pretty much every time we are asked to do something by faith, it's a test. Are we going to do it or not? Or are we going to be filled with doubt or other problems and walk away from it? I do. Good question. Do you think all of Noah's family worked on the ark? Well, since the scripture doesn't say, you can only speculate. I try to stay away from speculating, but my guess would be they did.
And it's quite possible that he hired other people to help him do a lot of that work as well. And of course, it did take a century to do it, so I don't know if eight people, or actually four, I don't know how much physical work the women would have been able to do. Of course, compared to my mom and my wife and Hope's grandmothers, the women could have done more than the men. But I'm just assuming they probably all did, but no way to know for sure. Recommendations for getting said faith. Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. That's a short verse, so sometimes it's hard to tell what to do, especially when the world has convinced you to doubt the Bible's validity. You're exactly right on that. And if there's anything Satan will attack us Christians on, it's the soundness of our faith. And I don't know, if you eliminate the trust, you've eliminated everything. And so the best advice I can give you off the top of my head is to, if you have problems with maybe beginning to doubt the Bible's validity, you need to get to work and shore that up. There's all kinds of evidence within the Bible itself, all kinds of stuff people have written about what the Bible says, that if your heart's right, if your heart's open, you can shore that faith up in short order and then fill yourself with what it says. Because when we act by faith, we're acting, it's a reaction to what the Word of God is teaching us to do. And the more impossible or the more difficult it seems to do, the more certain it is we really have to be sure that what we're calling faith really is faith, and not just my response to what other people are thinking or telling me. And if you are keeping company with some of these people that are trying to cause you to cast doubt, stay away from those people. Get away from them. And what Paul say in 1 Corinthians, come out from among them and be separate. Don't fill your life with those kind of people. Fill your life with God and His Word, and do whatever you need to do to study that book from one end to the other and study the evidences as to why that's the only book like it in all the history of the human race. It just can't, no other book can stand this kind of scrutiny that the Bible can stand. Many times in the Gospels, it says the apostles believed. So does that mean that they had lost faith each time before they believed again? That's a good question. But no, I don't think it ever says they believed again, which would indicate that started and stopped, started and stopped. I don't think that's the implication. I think it's stating their reaction to what happened at that particular time. Was it water turned to wine? Was it somebody raised from the dead? Was it something else when they saw this, a blind man healed? They believed. What did they believe? Now, that's the question, particularly if you study the Gospel of John, because you find all these, he did this and they believed. He did this and they believed. But yet, at the end, what did they all do? Scattered, ran away. So, and they believed, but they weren't really deep in their understanding. And that's why Jesus, from time to time, rebuked them, isn't it? And even called them at one time, ye of little faith. And I think there's a question in here that relates to that. So no, they kept believing in the power they saw demonstrated, and they kept believing in the things that he was telling them, but they didn't really understand the repercussions of what he was telling them. And I don't think it was possible for their faith to gel completely like ours is capable of gelling until all of those events were finished. And he was raised from the dead, and then they were able to put all the pieces together and it made sense. At least that's my perspective on what happened on that. But they had lots of these believing moments, but they weren't all together in what we would call a solid faith until later. Genesis 6 verse 4 says, when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men, who are the sons of God? And it's okay if you would prefer to discuss this offline or off time. I should have known someone was going to ask that question. Well, you know, since the Bible doesn't tell us, my favorite answer is, I don't know. The two most common explanations are that they were angels who came down and cohabited with women and gave birth to a race of giants that hadn't been on the earth before that happened. A lot of problems with that. Others say they are, because this comes right after the genealogy of the sons of Adam and Eve. And we know that the descendants of Cain were basically described as wicked people, and the descendants of Seth, Shem, were described more along the righteous line. He's the one through whom Christ came. And so the idea is it was the godly line coming together with the ungodly line, and things went downhill fast, resulting in the flood. But since God chose not to tell us exactly, that's about as close as I can get to answering that. Pick your poison. And then just, be convinced in your own mind. But another approach, and maybe I shouldn't say this, but this is a feeling I have toward a lot of things that God just chose not to tell us, which is, what difference does it make? It doesn't affect me one way or the other. Whether it was an angel, angels, whether it was the descendants of Shem, that doesn't keep me awake at night. I've got enough things in my life that can keep me awake at night, but that's not one of them. So don't let someone throw you off by trying to figure out something God chose not to tell us. In the light of Jesus' repeated rebuke, O ye of little faith, it seems we often do need greater faith. Might not the as a mustard seed refer not only to the size, but the effectiveness of it? Compare when he said that the kingdom of heaven is like the mustard seed or like leaven. What's a good observation? And it's a good question. When he says, oh, ye of little faith, I don't think he's talking about the quantity. I think he's talking about the quality. Where I think we would say it, oh, ye of weak faith. Because they kept giving in to that and giving in to that and doubting themselves and doubting this power that he gave them on occasion. Because right after he says, ye of little faith, he says, all you need is that much. So if it's genuine, if it's the genuine stuff, you don't need much. You just need that. And then you need to act on it. And sort of like me, I remember many years ago living in Ohio. My two sons were teenagers, and we had way out in the backyard a metal bar that somebody who had lived there before put up. And my sons, it was a big swing set. That's what it was that my wife's father had built. Cast iron, things still alive. But it was out there. They loved to shinny up the support poles and then walk across the beam hand over hand. Well, I was out there one day watching them, congratulating on it. I knew I stayed too long. Well, one of them says, Dad, you do it. And I knew I was past my pole climbing prime. But like a foolish father trying to impress his teenage boys, I shinnied up the support pole, and as soon as I let go holding onto that thing, I knew I'd made a big mistake. So hand after hand, I grunted my way across, and I got to thinking, man, if I just had more muscles. Then it hit me, no, I don't need more muscles. I just need better use of the ones I've got, because I'd let them lapse. And I think that's true of faith. We need to tune it up, firm it up, be sure it's pure, and we don't need much to get by. To what extent should we plan ahead while still trusting that God will work his plan in a way that he sees fit? How can we reconcile what good things we might want to do with what God wants or doesn't want us to do? That's a great question. And I think the key to that, let me read part of it again. To what extent should we plan ahead while still trusting that God will work his... That's the answer to that. We plan ahead, but we plan trusting that God will steer the rudder. I could stand here for the next 30 minutes and tell you of things in my life where I've planned one thing and set out to accomplish it. And somewhere along the line, the path took a divergent direction. And in every one of the cases, I think it was because all the time I was praying that God would give me wisdom, that God would undo anything I was about to do that wasn't according to his will, that if this wasn't wise, he would help me see that and he'd open another door. And my life is filled with stories like that, and that's probably true with a lot of you here. Trusting in God to provide the promises he has made, to give wisdom, to give understanding, to give his help, to help us to overcome this world, but it's essential we do our part. I remember a time early in life, I was a high school senior, fell in love with a high school junior. She was converted after we studied together for a while. My plan was to marry this girl. Her name was Kathy. And I was praying all along, you know, for God to guide everything, to be sure I married the woman he thought was best for me. And man, I was on my way. Then one night she gave me my ring back. Totally unexpected. Of course, I've been clueless about many things. And no doubt I should have seen the signs, but I didn't. She gave me the ring back. Didn't want anything more to do with me. She had had enough of Royce Chandler. And looking back now, I can understand why. But I didn't understand it at the moment. Well, my plans are all shattered, absolutely shattered. My prayers remain the same. I didn't stop trusting in God. And then suddenly this thing happened that I don't have time to tell you about. Another thing happened I don't have time to tell you about. Four or five other things happened. And lo and behold, I find myself on the campus of Florida College. And one of the first girls I meet is the girl I eventually married. I should never have been there at the same time she was. Because first year after I graduated, my father died that fall. I stayed home with my mom and my two younger siblings. Worked two or three different kinds of jobs. Then I went to a state school out just south of Amarillo for a year and a summer. And finally wound up at Florida College. She happened to come the same time I did. And that's only, you know, that much of that long a story. But my prayers remain the same. But I can look back now and see, well, you know, it was a real blessing that that girl gave me my ring back, because I didn't have enough understanding, even about myself, to understand that was a horrible plan. Because ever since I was about 10 years old, all I ever wanted to do was be, I wanted to be two things. I wanted to be a preacher, and I wanted to be a cowboy. Not a Dallas cowboy, I mean a real cowboy. Those were the two things I wanted to do. Well, I never made a cowboy, and some folks say I never made the other. But that was my dream. That was my passion. I wanted to preach. You know, and long after the event of that ring being given back, I could look back and with more understanding then about a lot of things as to how I never would have done what I most passionately wanted to do had that plan worked out. But trusting in God, he provided this, he provided the breakup, he provided other things that finally put me in a situation for the woman he knew I needed. And so I, you know, I've thanked him for that many, many times. And that's the way it is. What about your college career? Why are you pursuing the college career you're pursuing if you're still in pursuit of one or you're about to begin it? What's the purpose of that? What's your basic reason for choosing that career? If it's money, if it's something else, okay. Those are motives that drive people. But to me, the most compelling reason to have any kind of a job or any kind of a major looking forward to a job is, what can I do with the skill set that I have? And what options might be out there? What can I do that will best put me in a position to glorify God with my life? And if I'm making my decision based on something less than that, I shouldn't be surprised if things don't go well and I run into all kinds of problems. But if God knows that's where my heart is, I have to trust him while I go ahead and plan, and I'm trusting him and asking him to please guide this, because I don't always know what's best, to shift the rudder when I need to be shifted. And if we trust him, he'll do it. He'll always do it. And I've been surprised by a great many things in my life. I never planned in any way whatsoever to be involved in Spanish work. I never gave it a thought. I had 2 years of Spanish in high school. Had to force myself to live through it because I liked my Spanish teacher, but she was one of these women, and I don't know how it affects anybody else, but she would say a phrase. We had to say it back, but I couldn't look at her because for whatever reason, I've got this tick about things. She would say a phrase and then leave her mouth wide open. Buenos dias. And I just couldn't do it. Just couldn't do it. So I went through 2 years of that. And many years later, after I finally achieved my version of being a preacher, one day I got this letter in the mail from, I told you all about it in March, from a prisoner in Atlanta asking for a correspondence course. Okay, it's pretty normal. We got several of those. And before the year was over, I was involved in the work in Columbia, South America. I always say I got sort of sucked backwards into it. But now it's a major part of my life. It has been for 37 years. And that was a case of me wanting to serve, asking for ways to serve. I wasn't planning on that, but God shifted the rudder. And lo and behold, aquí yo estoy, hablando con palabras españolas. Thank you, Stephen. On the ball. Great questions. I appreciate those very, very much. Hope you'll all come back tomorrow morning. Look forward to it. Thank you.